All right, this is chapter 3 of Jonathan Edwards' Charity and Its Fruits, entitled The Greatest Performances or Sufferings in Vain Without Charity. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. 1 Corinthians 13:3. In the previous verses of this chapter, the necessity and excellence of charity are set forth, as we have seen, by its preference to the greatest privileges and the utter vanity and insignificance of these privileges without it. The privileges particularly mentioned are those that consist in the extraordinary gifts of the Spirit of God. In this verse, things of another kind are mentioned, those that are of a moral nature. It is declared that none of these avail anything without charity. First, particularly, our performances are in vain without it. Here is one of the highest kinds of external performances mentioned, giving all our goods to feed the poor. Giving to the poor is a duty very much insisted on in the Word of God, and particularly under the Christian dispensation. And in the primitive times of Christianity, the circumstances of the church were such that persons were sometimes called to part with all they had, and to give it away to others. This was partly because of the extreme necessities of those who were persecuted and in distress, and partly because the difficulties that attended being a follower of Christ and doing the work of the Gospels were such as called the disciples to disentangle themselves from the care and burden of their worldly possessions, and to go forth, as it were, without gold or silver in their purses, or scrip, or even 2 coats apiece. The Apostle Paul tells us that he had suffered the loss of all things for Christ, and the primitive Christians in the church at Jerusalem sold all that they had and gave it into a common fund, and none said that aught that he had was his own. Acts 4:32. The duty of giving to the poor was a duty that the Christian Corinthians at this time had particular occasion to consider, not only because of the many troubles of the times, but by reason also of a great dearth or famine that sorely distressed the brethren in Judea. In view of this, the apostle had already urged it on the Corinthians as their duty to send relief to them, speaking of it particularly in this epistle in chapter 16, and also in his second epistle to the same church in chapters 8 through 9. And yet, though he says so much in both of these epistles to stir them up to the duty of giving to the poor, still he is very careful to inform them that though they should go never so far in it, yea, though they should bestow all their goods to feed the poor and have not charity, it would profit them nothing. Second, the apostle teaches that not only for our performances, but also our sufferings are of no avail without charity. Men are ready to make much of what they do, but more of what they suffer. They are ready to think it a great thing when they put themselves out of their way, or are at great expense or suffering for their religion. The apostle here mentions a suffering of the most extreme kind, suffering even to death, and that one of the most terrible forms of death, and says that even this is nothing without charity. When a man has given away all his goods, he has nothing else remaining that he can give but himself. And the apostle teaches that when a man has given all his possessions, if he then goes on to give his own body, and that to be utterly consumed in the flames, it will avail nothing if it is not done from sincere love in the heart. The time when the apostle wrote to the Corinthians was a time when Christians were often called not only to give their goods, but their bodies also, for Christ's sake. For the church then was generally under persecution, and multitudes were then, or soon after, put to very cruel deaths for the gospel's sake. But though they suffered in life, or endured the most agonizing death, it would be in vain without charity. What is meant by this charity has already been explained in the former lectures on these verses, in which it has been shown that charity is the sum of all that is distinguishing in the religion of the heart. And therefore, the doctrine that I would derive from these words is this. Doctrine. All that men can do and all that they can suffer can never make up for the lack of sincere Christian love in the heart. There may be great performances, and so there may be great sufferings without sincere Christian love in the heart. The Apostle Paul in Philippians 3 tells us what things he did before his conversion and while he remained a Pharisee. In verse 4 he says, "If any other man thinketh that he hath whereof he might trust in the flesh, I more." Many of the Pharisees did great things and abounded in religion's performances. The Pharisee mentioned in Luke 18:11 through 12 boasted of the great things that he had done towards both God and men, and thanked God that he so exceeded other men in his doings. And many of the heathen have been eminent for their great performances, some for their integrity, some for their justice, and others for their great deeds done for the public good. Many men, without any sincerity of love in their hearts, have been exceedingly magnificent in their gifts for pious and charitable uses, and have thus gotten to themselves great fame, and had their names handed down in history to posterity with great glory. Many have done great things from fear of hell, hoping thereby to appease the deity and make atonement for their sins. And many have done great things from pride and from a desire for reputation and honor among men. And though these motives are not wont to influence men to a constant and universal obedience of God's commands, and to go on with a course of Christian performances and with the practice of all duties toward God and man through life, yet it is hard to say how far such natural principles may carry men in particular duties and performances. There may be great sufferings for religion, and yet no sincerity of love in the heart. Persons may undergo great sufferings in life, just as some of the Pharisees used themselves to great severities and to penances and voluntary inflictions. Many have undertaken wearisome pilgrimages and have shut themselves out from the benefits and pleasures of the society of mankind, or have spent their lives in deserts and solitudes, and some have suffered death, of whom we have no reason to think that they had any sincere love to God in their hearts. Multitudes among the papists have voluntarily gone and ventured their lives in bloody wars in hopes of meriting heaven by it. In the wars carried on with the Turks and Saracens, called the Holy Wars or Crusades, thousands went voluntarily to all the dangers of the conflict in the hope of thus securing the pardon of their sins and the rewards of glory hereafter. Excuse me. Many thousands, yea, some millions, in this way lost their lives, even to the depopulation, in a considerable measure, of many parts of Europe. And many of the Turks were engaged by this exceedingly, so as to venture their lives and rush, as it were, upon the very points of the swords of their enemies, because Muhammad has promised that all who die in war in defense of the Muhammadan faith shall go at once to paradise. History tells us of some who have yielded themselves to voluntary death out of mere obstinacy and sturdiness of spirit, rather than yield to the demands of others, when they might, without dishonor, have saved their lives. Many among the heathen have died for their country, and many as martyrs for a false faith, though not in any wise in such numbers, nor in any such manner as those who have died as martyrs for true religion. And in all these cases, many, doubtless, have endured their sufferings or met death without having any sincere divine love in their hearts. Number 2. But whatever men may do or suffer, they cannot, by all their performances and sufferings, make up for the want of sincere love in the heart. If they lay themselves out never so much in the things of religion, and are never so much engaged in acts of justice and kindness and devotion, if their prayers and fastings are never so much multiplied, or if they should spend their time ever so much in the forms of religious worship, giving days and nights to it, and denying sleep to their eyes and slumber to their eyelids, that they might be more laborious in religious exercises, if the things that they should do in religion were such as to get them a name throughout the world and make them famous to all future generations, it would all be in vain without sincere love for God in the heart. And so, if a man should give most bounteously to religious or charitable uses, and if, possessing the riches of a kingdom, he should give it all, and from the splendor of an earthly prince should reduce himself to the level of beggars, and if he should not stop there, but when he had done all this, should yield himself to undergo the fiercest sufferings, giving up not only all his possessions, but also giving his body to be clothed in rags, or to be mangled and burned and tormented as much as the wit of man could conceive, even all this would not make up for the want of sincere love for God in the heart. And it is plain that it would not, for the following reasons. Reason 1. It is not the external work done or the suffering endured that is in itself worth anything in the sight of God. The motions and exercise of the body, or anything that may be done by it, if considered separately from the heart, the inward part of the man, is of no more consequence or worth in the sight of God than the motions of anything without life. If anything is offered or given, though it be silver, gold, or the cattle on 1,000 hills, though it be 1,000 rams or 10,000s of rivers of oil, there is nothing of value in it as an external thing in God's sight. If God were in need of these things, they might be of value to him, considered in themselves, independently of the motives of the heart that led to them to their being offered. We often stand in need of external good things, and therefore such things, offered or given to us, may or do have a value to us in themselves considered. But God stands in need of nothing. He is all-sufficient in himself. He is not fed by the sacrifices of beasts, nor enriched by the gift of silver, gold, or pearls. Every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon 1,000 hills. If I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine and the fullness thereof. Psalm 50, verse 10 and 12. All things come of thee, and of thine own have we given thee. O Lord our God, all this store that we have prepared to build thee a house for thine holy name cometh of thine hand, and is all thine own. 1 Chronicles 29, 14 and 16. And as there is nothing profitable to God in any of our services or performances, so there can be nothing acceptable in his sight in a mere external action without sincere love in the heart. For the Lord seeth not as men seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but God looketh on the heart. The heart is just as naked and open to him as the external actions, and therefore he sees our actions and all our conduct not merely as the external motions of a machine, but as the actions of rational, intelligent creatures and voluntary free agents. And therefore there can be, in his estimation, no excellence or amiableness in anything we can do if the heart is not right with him. And so God takes no pleasure in any sufferings that we may endure in themselves considered. He is not profited by the torments men may undergo, nor does he delight to see them putting themselves to sufferings, unless it is for some good motive or to some good purpose and end. We sometimes may need for our fellow men or friends and neighbors to suffer for us, to help us bear our burdens and put themselves to inconvenience for our sake. But God stands in no such need of us, and therefore our sufferings are not acceptable to him, considered merely as sufferings endured by us, and are of no account apart from the motive that leads us to endure them. No matter what may be done or suffered, neither doings nor sufferings will make up for the want of love for God in the soul. They are not profitable to God, nor lovely for their own sake in his sight. Nor can they ever make up for the absence of that love for God and love for men that is the sum of all that God requires of his moral creatures. Reason number 2. Whatever is done or suffered, yet if the heart is withheld from God, there is nothing really given to him. The act of the individual in what he does or suffers is in every case looked upon not as the act of a lifeless engine or machine, but as the act of an intelligent, voluntary, moral being. For surely a machine is not properly capable of giving anything, and if any such machine that is without life, being moved by springs or weights, places anything before us, it cannot properly be said to give it to us. Harps and cymbals and other instruments of music were of old made use of in praising God in the temple and elsewhere, but these lifeless instruments could not be said to give praise to God because they had no thought, no understanding, no will, and no heart to give value to their pleasant sounds. And so, though a man has a heart, an understanding, and a will, yet if when he gives anything to God he gives it without his heart, there is no more truly given to God than is given by the instrument of music. He who has no sincerity in his heart has no real respect for God in what he seems to give, or in all his performances or sufferings, and therefore God is not his great end in what he does or gives. What is given to that which the individual makes his great end in giving. If his end is only himself, then it is given only to himself and not to God. If his aim is his own honor, ease, or worldly profit, then the gift is but an offering to these things. The gift is an offering to him to whom the giver's heart devotes, and for whom he designs it. It is the aim of the heart that makes the reality of the gift. And if the sincere aim of the heart is not to God, then there is in reality nothing given to him, no matter what is performed or suffered. So it would be a great absurdity to suppose that anything that can be offered or given to God can make up for the absence of love in the heart for him. For without this, nothing is truly given, and the seeming gift is but a mockery of the Most High. Reason number 3. This further appears from the fact that this love or charity is the sum of all that God requires of us. And it is absurd to suppose that anything can make up for the want of that which is the sum of all that God requires. Charity or love is something that has its seat in the heart and in which, as we have seen, consists all that is saving and distinguishing in Christian character. This love it is of which our Savior speaks as the sum of all required in the two tables of the law, and which the Apostle declares is the fulfilling of the law. How can we make up for the defect when, by withholding it, we do in effect withhold the sum total of all that God requires of us? It would be absurd to suppose that we can make up for one thing that is required by offering another that is required, and that we can make up for one debt by paying another. But it is still more absurd to suppose that we can make up for the whole debt without paying anything, but by continuing still to withhold all that is required. As to external things without the heart, God speaks of them as not being the things that he has required, in Isaiah 1:12, and demands that the heart be given to him if he would have the external thing, the external offering, accepted. Reason number 4. If we make a great show of respect and love for God in the outward actions while there is no sincerity in the heart, it is but hypocrisy and practical lying unto the Holy One. To pretend to such respect and love when it is not felt in the heart, is to act as if we thought we could deceive God. It is to do as Israel did in the desert after they had been delivered from Egypt, when they are said to have lied unto God with their mouths and to have flattered him with their tongues, Psalm 78:36. But surely it is as absurd to suppose that we can make up for the want of sincere respect by flattery and guile as to suppose we can make up for the want of truth by falsehood and lying. Reason number five. Whatever may be done or suffered, if there is no sincerity in the heart, it is all but an offering to some idol. As observed before, there is nothing in the case supposed really offered to God, and therefore it will follow that it is offered to some other being, object, or end, and whatever that may be, it is what the scriptures call an idol. In all such sufferings, something is virtually worshipped, and whatever it is, be it self, our fellow men, or the world that is allowed to usurp the place that should be given to God and to receive the offerings that should be made to Him. And how absurd to suppose we can make up for withholding from God that which is His due by offering something to our idol. It is as absurd as it is to suppose that the wife can make up for the want of love to her husband by giving that affection which is due to him to another man who is a stranger, or that she can make up for her want of faithfulness to him by the guilt of adultery. Application. Use of examination. If it be indeed so that all we can do or suffer is in vain if we do not have sincere love for God in the heart, then it should put us upon searching ourselves whether or not we have this love in sincerity in our hearts. There are many who make a profession and show of religion, and some who do many of the outward things which it requires, and possibly they may think that they have done and suffered much for God and His service. But the great inquiry is, has the heart been sincere in it all, and has all been suffered or done from a regard to the divine glory? Doubtless, if we examine ourselves, we may see much of hypocrisy. But is there any sincerity? God abominates the greatest things without sincerity, but He accepts and delights in little things when they spring from sincere love for Him. A cup of cold water given to a disciple in sincere love is worth more in God's sight than all one's goods given to feed the poor, yea, than the wealth of a kingdom given away or a body offered up in the flames without love. And God accepts even a little sincere love. Though there is a great deal of imperfection yet, if there is any true sincerity in our love, that little shall not be rejected because there is some hypocrisy with it. And here it may be profitable to observe that there are these four things that belong to the nature of sincerity: truth, freedom, integrity, and purity. Truth. The first thing that belongs to the nature of sincerity is truth. There is that truly in the heart of which is the appearance and show in the outward action. Where this is, indeed, true respect for God, the love that honors Him will be felt in the heart just as extensively as there is a show made of it in the words and actions. In this sense, it is said in Psalm 51, "Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts." And in this view it is that sincerity is spoken of in the scriptures as the opposite of hypocrisy, and that a sincere Christian is said to be one who is such indeed as he appears to be, one without guile. John 1 verse 47. Examine yourself, therefore, with respect to this matter. If in your outward actions there is an appearance or show of respect for God, inquire if it is only external, or if it is sincerely felt in your heart. For without real love or charity, you are nothing. Freedom. The second thing in the nature of sincerity is freedom. On this account, especially the obedience of Christians is called filial, or the obedience of children, because it is an ingenuous, free obedience. It is not legal, slavish, and forced, but that which is performed from love and with delight. God is chosen for his own sake, and God is chosen for his own sake, and holiness is chosen for its sake and for God's sake. Christ is chosen and followed because he is loved, and religion because it is loved, and the soul rejoices in it, finding in its duties the highest happiness and delight. Examine yourself faithfully on this point, whether or not this spirit is yours. Integrity. The third thing belonging to the nature of this sincerity is integrity. The word signifies wholeness, intimating that where this sincerity exists, God is sought and religion is chosen and embraced with the whole heart and adhered to with the whole soul. Holiness is chosen with the whole heart. The whole of duty is embraced and entered upon most cordially, whether it has respect to God or to man, whether it is easy or difficult, whether it has reference to little things or great. There is a proportion and fullness in the character. The whole man is renewed. The whole body and soul and spirit are sanctified. Every member is yielded to the obedience of Christ. All the parts of the new creature are brought into subjection to his will. The seeds of all holy dispositions are implanted in the soul, and they will more and more bear fruit in the performance of duty and for the glory of God. Purity. The fourth thing that belongs to the nature of sincerity is purity. The word sincere often signifies pure. So it is in 1 Peter 2:2, as newborn babes desiring the sincere milk of the word, that ye may grow thereby, that is, pure, unmixed, and unadulterated milk of the word. This appears in the opposition of virtue to sin. The one is spoken of as defilement, impurity, and uncleanness, and the other is that which is free from these things. The apostle compares sin to a body of death, or a dead body, that which of all things is most polluting and defiling, while holiness is spoken of as purity, and holy pleasures as pure pleasures, and the saints in heaven as being without spot before the throne of God. Inquire, then, whether this purity is yours, and whether in its possession you find the evidence that you sincerely love God. Use of conviction. This subject may also convince those who are still in an unregenerate state of their lost condition. Excuse me. If it is indeed that by all you can either do or suffer, you cannot make up for the want of a holy, sincere principle of love in your heart, then it will follow that you are in an undone condition till you have obtained God's regenerating grace to renew a right spirit within you, and that, do what you will, or undergo and suffer what you will, you cannot be delivered from your wickedness without the converting grace of God. If you make never so many prayers, those will not make your case less miserable unless God, by his mighty power, is pleased to give you a new heart. If you take never so much pains in religion, cross and deny yourselves, and do or suffer never so much, all will not avail without this. Therefore, whatever you have done, though you can look back upon a great many prayers offered, and much time spent in reading and meditation, you have no reason to think that these things have made any atonement for your sins, rendered your case any the less deplorable, or left you anything other than a wretched, lost, miserable, guilty, and ruined creature. Natural and unrenewed men would be glad to have something to make up for their want of sincere love and real grace in their hearts. Many do great things to make up for a want of it, while others are willing to suffer great things. But alas, how little it all signifies. No matter what they may do or suffer, it does not change their character. And if they build their hopes upon it, they merely delude themselves and feed upon the east wind. If such is your case, Consider how miserable you will be while you live without hope in the only true source of hope, and how miserable you will be when you come to die, when the sight of the King of Terrors will show that the nothingness and vanity of all your doings. How miserable you will be when you see Christ coming to judgment in the clouds of heaven. Then you will be willing to do and suffer anything that you may be accepted by him. But doings or sufferings will not avail. They will not atone for your sins, give you God's favor, or save you from the overwhelming storms of his wrath. Rest then on nothing that you have done or suffered, or that you can do or suffer, but rest on Christ. Let your heart be filled with sincere love for him, and then, at the last great day, he will own you as his follower and as his friends. Use of exhortation. This subject exhorts all to earnestly cherish sincere Christian love in their hearts. If it is so that this is of such great and absolute necessity, then let it be the one great thing that you seek. Seek it with diligence and prayer, and seek it from God and not from yourself. He alone can bestow it. It is something far above the unassisted power of nature, for though there may be great performances and great sufferings too, yet without sincere love they are all in vain. Such doings and sufferings may indeed be required of us as the followers of Christ and in the way of duty, but we are not to rest in them or feel that they have any merit or worthiness in them. At best, they are but the outward evidence and the outflowing of a right spirit in the heart. Be exhorted, then, as the great thing, to cherish sincere love or Christian charity in the heart. It is that which you must have, and there is nothing that will help your case without it. Without it, all will, in some respect, but tend to deepen your condemnation and to sink you to but lower depths in the world of despair.